Welcome, everyone. This is Paul Keaton, and joining me today is J. Greg Nanny, and this is first week of May. We survived another seasonally strong period in the market. We survived 100 days under the Trump presidency. We survived the trip from NASDAQ Composite 5,000 to 6,000 with a brief pit stop at 1,000, almost?
Just about. I think 1,100 is where the
1,100 was the bottom. Yeah. Okay. Where you want to start?
That's a good place to start as any. You know, we talked last week. It's interesting. Last week on the podcast, we talked about the trip for the NASDAQ Composite Index here recently to from 5,000 to 6,000, and the fact that it took just over 17 years, but from when it hit 5,000 to when it hit 6,000 took about 17 years. And it's interesting, we put a poll up. So we mentioned last week we were going to put it up. We put a poll up on the website. So if you're on the website logged in, there's a banner right on your dashboard page where you can see it in the message board. And the question basically is, how long will it take, or how long do you think it'll take for the NASDAQ Composite to go from 6,000 to 7,000, so the next 1,000-point move in the NASDAQ. So we've gotten about 30 or so responses from now. If you log into the site, go and cast your vote. It's going to be interesting to see where that comes in. And oftentimes, it's like the idea of wisdom of the crowds, right, where you get this aggregated information out there that oftentimes – when you get a big sample set like that, you tend to get a pretty good accuracy in terms of where and or how long in this case the NASDAQ Composite will take to hit 7,000. So interesting, fun poll we'll put out there. We'll present the results as we get them, probably in the podcast next week.
So we know that an environment like 1999 could yield a 1,000-point move in a couple months, then another 1,000-point move in a couple months, or the flip side of that, it was what, the move from 2000 to just now, 5,000, 6,000 was how long?
17 years.
17 years,
yeah.
Good grief.
Here we are sitting at new all-time highs on the NASDAQ, and you know, obviously a lot of that, you look at the NASDAQ Composite or the NASDAQ 100 and DX, and what's driving a lot of that is the large cap tech. So big growth type of companies is what you're seeing in many instances drive the NASDAQ Composite. And even to some extent, while some of the other market indexes haven't quite gotten back to new highs, in the case of the S&P 500, it's moved back to a near-term buy signal in its chart. But even when you look underneath the surface of all of these indexes, the things that have been driving the returns has really been the growth area of the market, and in particular some of these large-cap growth technology companies that have been leading the way so far this year.
Kind of like it was 17 years ago.
Kind of like it was 17 years ago.
You know, there's a few.
So maybe the poll question should be, when, how long does it take to go back to 1,000?
No, let's not
think about that.
Let's not do that. Okay. But you know, this is a, you know, we talk about it, and it's, you know, it's an interesting data point. NASDAQ Composite 6,000. Obviously, you had, you know, the, you know, Dow 20,000, and you know, that's another interesting data point. But why it might be an interesting conversation with some clients is because it does allow you, I think, to bring up some of the hot button topics today and talk about the longevity of markets and how things ebb and flow. We talk about how a lot of the large cap growth stocks today are really what has led the market. In fact, you know, look at the S&P 500 this year, only one style box of the market is outperforming the S&P 500, and it's large growth. So if you looked at mid-growth, small growth, mid-value, small value, even large value, none of those are outperforming the market. So it has been relatively narrow leadership, if we define leadership as simply things that are outperforming the cap-weighted S&P. Now, that also was the case back in 1999 and early 2000. And it was, you could compare today's environment with that in a couple ways. And not to say that we're in a, you know, the 11th inning of a, 11th hour of a bubble environment. But let's go back and think about what also was happening in the late 90s was you had an environment where the S&P 500 was outperforming 90% of all active managers. And that's looking at a five-year rolling return. If you look at current five-year rolling return, the S&P 500 is outperforming about 90% of active portfolio managers. So what does that cause in today's environment? It's this indexing discussion, right? Indexing mania, you might say, where fees are really being put through the ringer. Clients are asking, well, gosh, I saw this in the Wall Street Journal. I saw that on, CNBC. What's this indexing thing? Why can't we just index me and save me some money? And that was really the same thing that was happening in the late 90s, but you didn't have all these index products available to the average investor in the way that they are now. So what did Mr. Jones do? Well, he didn't so much go and quote-unquote index. He e-traded, right?
Right, yeah.
He went and closed his brokerage account that had, $50 commissions per trade or more, and he went and took advantage of the, $15 trades that were available on E-Trade. And that was a mass exodus from Wall Street. A ton of accounts closed in traditional wirehouses, and a ton of accounts opened and self-serviced through outfits like E-Trade. And that was right in front of what was a really tough market. And a lot of people were really pushed out of the investment business for a while because they were devastated by the 2000 through 2012 or 2002 market. And that's something I think that is a conversation worth having. When a client comes to you and says, well, let's just index, let's just buy the S&P 500, let's talk about that NASDAQ trip. 17 years it would have taken a buy and hold investor in the NASDAQ composite. Mm-hmm. If he happened to be unlucky and buy the wrong day in March of 2000, it just took him 17 years to get back to even, assuming he didn't capitulate at some point on the way down to 1100.
Right.
And that's what conventional indexing can't solve for. It can't solve for the behavior side of investors. And it's the type of thing that you're going to get these seismic changes in our business whenever you go through a period where the S&P is outperforming 90% of active managers. You're going to go through that. And this isn't the first time it happened. It's not the second time. You can go back in 1973, 74. You went through a similar scenario in the late 80s. You went through a similar scenario. And in each one of these stops, something changed about the business, whether it was the advent of index options or it was the proliferation, really the launch of the first real highly traded index products, whether it was the E-Trade phenomenon that changed the business quite a bit, or whether now it's the gravitation towards low-cost index options. It's very important now that you can talk about what your business adds over traditional indexing. And you can still use traditional indexes in your business, but there better be something else to it that lets your clients sleep at night knowing that it ain't going to be a 17-year get-back-to-even experience with my advisor.
Yeah. Well, and that's where having a process, having a game plan, having a discipline that can help remove some of that emotional attachment, because you think about it and you're like, geez, am I really back in 99 again? Mm-hmm. And you look at some of these numbers and there's certainly some comparable stats to it. Fortunately, we don't have to try and guess. We don't have to say, geez, maybe we are. Let's run for the hills and get out of the market. Where you look at a lot of the market indexes and indicators that we have in the system, and you see things like within Dolly, for those of you who look at our dynamic asset level investing, and you see U.S. equities for almost a year now since last August has been the number one ranked asset class within there. Mm-hmm. You look at things like the percent of stocks that are in positive trends today. And, historically, when that number has been above 50%, it has been conducive to a generally healthy market environment. You look today, and if you look at the indicator, the PTNYSE, so percent of stocks in the New York Stock Exchange that are in positive trends, that's at 66% today. It's been above 50% since June. So again, almost a year that it's been there. And when you go back and you look at this indicator, you look at those periods. First look back to 08, right? That's an environment certainly that everybody for probably the next 20 years will continue to have in their mind, will continue to say, whatever happens, do not let me go through another 2008 again. And look at how these indicators have navigated and reacted through 2008. I won't, lay out every single scenario here, but just in 2008, by January of 2008, so the very beginning of the year, in January of 2008, that that indicator, the percent of stocks in a positive trend, fell below 50%. You could go back to the 2009-2000 time period as well and look at it. And so it's very interesting when you look at it and you say, you know, we can certainly index, but let's have a plan to manage risk in those indexes so we don't have to sit here and wait 17 years to be able to get back to even if it is another one of those type of environments.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of interesting things you can go back and pull out of that last environment, you know, when the NASDAQ was originally hitting that peak. And I remember, you know, that year and, you know, having kind of grown up hearing the Warren Buffett name and Berkshire Hathaway and as, you know, one of the greatest investment strategies, not just investors, but really, value strategies of all time. You know, it was a irrefutable track record. But if you remember those late 90s, you know, Berkshire and Warren Buffett, you know, the performance was dramatically behind the S&P 500. People were throwing rocks at Warren Buffett in 1999. Berkshire had underperformed the S&P 500 by 60% from the middle of 1998 to the end of 1999. 60% for a theoretically fully invested strategy, it was a growth market. These things happen. You go in a growth market, you need your strategy to be able to find growth opportunity when it's there, and also be able to at some point have a process that allows you to recognize when that growth market is no longer supportive of future gains. Instead, it's the risk is not worth the reward. And so there's a lot of things. Every process and every program has to deal with the discussion of underperformance. And just know that right now, 90% roughly of all management programs are dealing with the fact that the S&P has been a extremely difficult benchmark over the past 5 years. What are some of the things that have outperformed the S&P 500 over the past 5 years? Well, probably a leveraged S&P 500. Probably a triple leveraged S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, you know, which owns, you know, about 400 fewer stocks, leveraged NASDAQ. You know, a lot of the programs that have outperformed are also things that are taking on more risk. And so if your business is built around risk-based strategies and suitability, you can't be scared to talk about that in this environment. And maybe talking about the past 17 years is an important way to begin that conversation. But instead of the last 17 years, let's talk about the next 6 months. Is that going to be good?
There's an old adage.
Oh, dear. Buy more in May?
There's an old adage out there in the market that it is, and you've all heard it, sell in May and go away. And, you know, the idea there is that the market historically produces all of its gains in the seasonally strong 6 months, and that is beginning at the very beginning in November and running all the way through the end of April. If you go back and you look at the numbers, all of the gains that the market has amassed over the years has come during those six-month period. The period from May through the end of October has historically not produced any net gains when you look over the body of the work over the years. And it's come with a lot of volatility over the years. You got, you know, the beginning of May into the summer months, things quiet down, people go on vacation. Then you get into the month of September that historically is the worst month out of all 12 for the market. And then, you know, October, while it might not be the worst month, October is historically a month that brings a little bit more volatility. And so, you know, the sell in May and go away adage is that, you know, you could go on vacation for the next 6 months and the market, all you're going to do is avoid a lot of volatility and probably a lot of anxiety over that next 6 months. But, you know, what we've got some numbers to kind of support that idea that you know, it is in fact the case that the sell in May and go away phenomenon adage certainly has something to it.
And this is another thing. When you talk about the client, talk about this idea with clients, it's important to, I think, tell both sides of the story. And one side is that, yeah, over the past 67 years, the net return, price return of an investment in the Dow Jones Industrial Average is actually negative if you only use those seasonally weak 6 months of the year to invest. All right, so 67 years. Now, the other side of that would be that of those 67 periods, let's say, 67 investments, if we look at them individually, 40 times out of 67, the market was actually up. And 27 times, the market was actually down in those 6 months. So in other words, I was told there'd be no math, but it's up more often than it's down in the seasonally weak period. So we shouldn't be surprised if the market over the next 6 months is up a bit. In fact, in 2016, the market was up 2.1% during the seasonally weak period. The problem really comes is that a lot of the double-digit drops are encapsulated by that in that seasonally weak period. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go back that far to find a few of those. And 2008 was obviously one of them, and the market was down 27%. 2012, it was down 15%. 2001, it was down 15% again, in that seasonally weak period. And it's just something that you don't see often in the seasonally strong side of the market. In this past 6 months, the market was up 15%, was the best six-month stretch or seasonal six-month stretch in quite a long time, going back to 1998. And so it was a very, very strong move for the U.S. market, and not all that uncommon, easy for me to say, in the context of the broader history. So the average gain is 0.4% in the seasonally weak periods and 7.6% in the seasonally strong periods. It's a big gap. Wow. Again, I think it deserves both sides of the story, and it's an undeniable, unmistakable kind of thing that you have to incorporate or can incorporate into your business. And there's different ways that you could do it. One of the things we often talk about is because the seasonally strong 6 months are often strong, at the end of it, you tend to have pretty low market volatility. Oftentimes, a positively trending market produces lower volatility, both lower realized volatility, but also lower implied volatility in the market. And it's that lower implied volatility that creates an opportunity to buy portfolio insurance very cheap. And so you look at the VIX index, which is the S&P 500 volatility index, or at least one of them. And VIX is the symbol. It's at a reading of 10, which is right around the all-time lows for that particular index. The recent spikes over the past couple years have taken that index into the mid-20s, for instance, and historic spikes have put that index well above 50 on a few occasions. But at 10, what that is telling you is that options are relatively cheap, or insurance for portfolios is relatively cheap. So if you have clients that are particularly concerned about this seasonally weak stretch that we have just entered, and you combine that with the fact that most of our U.S. equity indicators are quite strong, then maybe a right answer would be to talk about this idea of buying a six-month insurance policy for portfolios that would allow you to use something like S&P 500 put options or SPDR put options, whichever you prefer, and you could take the equity position of a portfolio. If it is built as a large cap core portfolio, then you could look at using index options or ETF options as a kind of one-stop shop to create a portfolio hedge, a short-term portfolio hedge for the portfolio, and you can do that at relatively low cost relative to trying to buy car insurance when your car is sinking in a lake or something like that.
Yeah.
Usually it's not
premiums usually spike.
Yeah, they spike. Yeah.
Precisely at that
time.
That's
right. That's right.
That's a great point. You mentioned that, and the sell in May and go away is, in many cases, to many investors, you see the headlines, and all you think is, you're paralyzed. What do you do? Do I really sell everything out of my portfolio? And that's making a big bet as well. To go 100% cash or that's making a bet. And so doing something proactive in the account right now that can provide a little bit of insurance, that can provide some comfort, that can help you at the end of the day sleep at night when you know you're headed into this market environment that is historically seasonally weak. The other thing that we talk about a lot today is having a strategy that can help de-risk the portfolio a little bit and consider something that given the fact that the vast majority of equity indicators are positive. Really, the only thing right now, if you look at it across the board, that would not be is the New York Stock Exchange bullish percent is still in a column of O's at this point in time. But if you look at, you know, some of the other things we talked about, having equity exposure today is certainly one right answer, and one right answer as we head into the seasonally weak period might be increasing exposure to lower volatility names, equity names in the portfolio, whether it's through individual securities or through an ETF like a PowerShares low volatility ETF symbol SPLV, or there's a number of other low volatility type of ETFs that are out there in the market. You know, that is one strategy today to maintain that exposure, but lower the overall volatility of that equity exposure through these types of names as we head into the next 6 months. And so we've got some models on our website that will actually do that rotate or overweight, underweight momentum and low volatility based on the seasonality idea. So the idea is that you want to overweight more of your momentum or growth area of the portfolio during the seasonally strong period in the market. And come May 1, we want to shift over a little bit and overweight the low volatility area of the market, underweight the growth a little bit. So, again, not the silver bullet only right answer, but certainly one right answer that you can be proactive in the account going forward.
Just in case the second 100 days aren't as good as the first 100 days under the Trump presidency.
Yeah, that's right. What the Trump presidency is now 100 days old, young. Yeah. What do you call it, young?
100 days done.
100 days done. That's a true statement. And I think the numbers on average, if you look back at all new incoming presidents, so ones that were actually elected, not taken over by other means, but ones that were actually elected, on average, the first 100 days for a new president is about 3% for the Dow Jones
index. Okay.
Trump was at 5.6%, so better than the average.
Much better than the average.
Much better.
Almost twice the average.
Almost twice the average. The best, you know who the best was? First 100 days as elected presidents after Inauguration Day.
Well, so you had what, Clinton would have come in at a pretty good time.
Clinton just edged out Trump at 5.7.
Is there someone better?
There's someone better.
Okay. Well, I'm Bush. Waiting with bated breath.
Bush.
Which one?
In 1989, when Bush was elected, 8.2% in his first 100 days. And then Kennedy was at 6.99%, so almost 7% back in January of 61.
Hmm. Well, we had talked about a Trump portfolio to begin the year, and it was the idea of buying the things that from the election until the end of that election year, the stocks that responded the most or rallied the most immediately following the election, the idea of buying that as a basket. Mm-hmm. And that basket, this time earlier, think about what happened in the election. Basically, the basket was like a bunch of financials and a bunch of energy stocks. And so that basket has a bunch of winners and a bunch of losers. I mean, you know, energy stocks have been really just brutal this year, and it's really been probably the most frustrating thing. I mean, a lot of returns are pretty good so far in 2016. A lot of participation in the market, but the one area that hasn't has been the energy and basic material stuff, and stocks like Chesapeake Energy, which really just exploded to the upside after the election, but it's down 24% so far this year. U.S. Steel's down 33% this year. Neighbors is one that's down almost 40% so far this year. And then on the other side of the equation, you've got a lot of the financials that have done quite well. Some of the big ones, you know, like a Bank of America or that type of thing has regained its footing, and it's now up a little bit more than the market so far this year. But others like SLM Corporation, Fiat Chrysler is actually the best of that bunch. So of the 50 stocks that performed the best right after the after the election until the end of 2016, the one that has done the best so far in 2017 is Fiat Chrysler, up almost 20% so far this year. So,
interesting. 20%, really?
Yeah, give or take. Yeah. So, some interesting things, hopefully plenty for you to talk about. While we are not necessarily selling in May, we are going away, and we will both potentially see some of you guys out at our Vegas Institute, which starts
this week,
sometime after we
Thursday,
get there,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, starts Thursday on bright and early Thursday morning. So we will see you out there if you're coming, and if you're not coming, you should have.
We'll see you next year.
That's right. We'll see you next year. Or maybe we'll talk to you next week. Thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.